Hello, and welcome once again to the Learning Digital Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Anderson, and you are listening to episode number 52. That's right, episode number 52 is finally coming your way. It's been a while since I've put a show out. It's been about 4 or 5 weeks. Been super crazy busy, so I'm just going to jump right in. We're not going to waste a lot of time with intros and news and stories and anecdotes. I'm going to basically be taking all the listener questions, well, the best of the listener questions and answers that I've gotten over the last 4 to 5 weeks over on the blog and through email. Decided it'd be a really good idea to put all of these questions together in a podcast form to deliver them back to the loyal listeners that are out there listening for the podcast, waiting for the podcast, coming up in just a minute with the best Q&As, so don't go away. Welcome to the show. Starting things off with our very first question. Like I said, I'm not going to waste any time. Very first question comes to us this week from Richard in, I think I'm saying this right, in Murfreesboro, North Carolina. It sounds familiar. I used to live on the East Coast. I'm not sure. This is actually a question I saw over in the NAPP forums. He had wrote in, writing a post saying that he had installed a new hard drive for extra photo storage, and it's making a lot of worrying noises. What should he do? And there was a lot of dialogue that went back and forth. I chimed in with some thoughts there as well. And the consensus was from the forum posts and dialogue that when a new hard drive is installed and it immediately starts making worrying noises, to take that hard drive out, well, first, back everything up, take that hard drive back out and swap it back out in an RMA or a return to manufacturer and get a replacement hard drive. Odds are the hard drive has gone bad. A couple other points that came out in the forum posts. Some people had mentioned that if you hear a whirring noise, it might not necessarily be the hard drive. You may have knocked a fan off balance and it needs to get the ball bearings back aligned so it could be the one that's producing the noise. It's a good point to try and check that out, but if you do know that a hard drive is making a lot of whirring noises, your best bet is to back up your data and replace the hard drive. Because as we all know, it's not if a hard drive crashes, it's when a hard drive crashes. And when a hard drive starts making whirring noises and weird sounds, that's usually an indication of an imminent drive failure. So if you hear noises coming from a hard drive, back it up, get your data copied, and then swap it out so you don't lose any of your important photos and files. Great question from Richard. Thank you very much. Next question coming right into the show here comes from Matt. He didn't give a city. He said he was in New England. And he emailed asking me about shooting tethered. For those of you that don't know, I did a video a while back on using the EOS utility, so I get a lot of questions about that. And his question about the EOS utility that suddenly stopped working in the middle of a shoot and wanted to know what to do. We went through a couple troubleshooting things, possibly reinstalling the EOS utility, possibly using Lightroom 2 or Lightroom 3, depending on what version he was using. And as it turned out, Matt actually had a very interesting scenario. He had an HP all-in-one scanner that was causing some kind of conflict. They had a couple options there where he could update the scanner to a new driver and that would stop the conflict. His option was to uninstall the added software that HP included with the scanner, and that restored the EOS functionality. So apparently you can have driver conflicts with software updates. That's something you want to be aware of. This particular issue came out from an HP all-in-one function that was resolved by removing the driver. I'll post the link that he provided to the forum community where we ultimately found the answer so people can reference that as well. But it's a good point about shooting tethered. It's not always necessarily hardware that could be the problem. It could be software, and it could be software completely unrelated to the one that you're actually using. You can have driver conflicts, especially inside of Windows, with software packages that have conflicting drivers. So that was a good question from Matt in New England. I wanted to share that here on the show. Our third question comes to us from Chris, I think it's a she, in Lima, Ohio. Spelled the name K-R-I-S. I'm not sure if it's a guy or a gal. But had a great question. They were asking about just getting a new 60D. So first off, congratulations on that. And they noticed that CS4 is not recognizing their RAW files. They're wondering why Adobe won't fix the Adobe Camera RAW for this new model. It's a good question because there is an assumption that Adobe supports its current iteration of software, which is CS5, and then one legacy version, CS4. And while it's true that they do support that, the fact of the matter is they don't continue research and development for the legacy system. So they'll support it, but they're not producing new programming for it. So that's why the Adobe Camera Raw for CS4 won't see additional updates. They're only going to be doing updates on Adobe Camera Raw for CS5. So if you don't want to spend the money on upgrading to CS5, there's a couple options for you. You can go with Lightroom if you happen to have that product. If you don't want to purchase Lightroom, if that's still a little too expensive for you, you could go with something like Photoshop Elements. That retails for $100 at the high end. You can get them on sale for as cheap as $60 or $70. But if you really don't want to spend any money, another great option out there is the Adobe DNG format. There's a DNG, which is a digital negative converter that Adobe puts out. They're trying to make this a standard. I think it's been approved. I think it's got ISO approval, where this will pretty much convert any format of RAW file to the digital negative format, which can then be read by anything that Adobe puts out there. And the understanding that I have, especially from reading a lot of forum community posts, is that it's a lot easier to maintain an independent RAW converter than it is to maintain an entire photography software program like Photoshop or Lightroom. So they can just take those codec changes when new cameras come out, add them to the latest version of Photoshop, and then also add those codecs to the DNG converter, and it doesn't take a lot of R&D to do that. And I think that's part of why they're putting that out there. So if you're not interested in purchasing a newer version of software, the best recommendation I have for you, Chris, is to purchase to go and download the Adobe DNG file converter. It's free. I'll throw a link in the show notes over to the DNG download for both Windows and Macintosh. Great question from Chris. Thank you very much. Question number 4 comes to us from Charles out of Wharton, New Jersey, and he wrote in, I'm assuming he's shooting a Canon camera, but he wrote in asking what he should be using to determine shutter count for his camera. He can't seem to find a way to locate this either in the camera or in the EXIF data for his images. It's a really good question because Canon, I don't believe, does this. So it's a really good question for Canon users. And a Windows-specific answer I have for you is a software program called EOS Info. And EOS should be easy enough to remember. And EOS Info comes to you. You can get it over at astrojargon.net. That's AstroJargon.net. It's a free download, so you don't have to pay anything for it. And all you do is download this file. It's an executable. You run the executable and then plug your camera in. It'll detect your camera and it'll give you a whole bunch of information. Everything from your serial number to the number of shutter actuations to all kinds of stuff about your camera that you probably never even knew you had. So go to astrojargon.net, download EOS Info, and you can get your shutter count for your camera using that methodology. For Nikon users, I know Nikon embeds the shutter actuation number information into the EXIF data. I'm not sure if it does it in the RAW files. I'm pretty sure it does it in JPEGs, because I know you can shoot in RAW and JPEG format, and it'll include that information in the EXIF data or the metadata for Nikon cameras. If you're not sure where to find it, or if I'm possibly off on this, which is not necessarily unlikely because I haven't run before, but there's a great application out there that I found for Nikon users, and it's called EXIF Reader, and I read about this over on Ken Rockwell's website. So if you go to kenrockwell.com, you can read about this EXIF Reader, and you can download that and install that, and it basically performs the same function as the EOS Info application for Canon camera users, where you can use that to look at the shutter count or the shutter actuations, as people like to call them, for whatever camera you happen to be running. You just basically plug your camera into your computer, run this program, and it'll tell you the shutter count. Another free resource out there is one called IrfanView, IrfanView. That can give shutter count information as well. So there's a couple options out there. I know some are operating system specific, so some are good on Windows, some are good on Mac, some are good on both, and some are OS specific. So depending on what operating system and camera vendor you're using, you might have to tweak these two particular ends to whatever suits your needs best. But those are three programs out there that I know of: EXIF Reader, EOS Info, and IrfanView, IrfanView. All of these are free, so go check them out. I'll provide links to each of these in the show notes as well. So that's a great question from Charles. Thank you very much for writing into the show. Our next question comes to us from Patrick in Vermont. Patrick wrote into a photography forum that I participate in, and he wrote in asking if anyone knows where he can get a basic tutorial on framing and matting. He's producing great prints but has no idea on how to properly mat them and get the photo to stick to the mat or mats and what procedures he can use. There are plenty of tutorials on how to frame and mat your photos. You can use Google, you can use Bing, you can use whatever search engine you like. There's lots of free resources out there. From my own experience, if you're going to cut your own photos, you're going to want to use a mat cutter. And you can get these at pretty much any arts and crafts store or hobby store. Hobby Lobby, Michaels, pick your vendor, whoever you want. If you go out and get a mat cutter, you can be assured of getting decent quality cuts, square cuts, crisp cuts using a mat cutter, much better than freehand cutting, so you're going to want to have something like that. As far as getting the photo to stick to a mat or to a backer board, there's a great spray-on adhesive made by 3M. I don't have the can of spray adhesive in front of me, but what I'll do is in the show notes I'll include the full name of the product and a link to where I can find it for cheap. I think I got mine at Lowe's or Home Depot. Maybe it was a hobby store, I don't remember. But I'll find a cheap one and I'll link to that in the show notes so you can visit that and save yourself some money. So that is a great question from Patrick. If anyone has any tutorials or reference material they'd like to include, feel free to stop over to the blog and comment or share your own thoughts on how to frame and match your photos. It's a really good question from Patrick. Thank you very much for writing into the show. Our next question is a little more involved. This comes to us from Robert in, in Oshawa, Canada. So not sure I'm pronouncing that city right. I apologize, Robert, if I'm saying that wrong. It's a great question. He writes in asking, is it possible to include hyperlinks in a slideshow? I've looked all through Lightroom, cannot figure out a way to do it. What I'd like to do, for example, is if I have a slideshow highlighting various aspects of a particular city, and I include a shot of a dish from a restaurant, could I include a hyperlink to that that would take that viewer to the restaurant's website or launch another slideshow? So basically the question is about adding hyperlinks inside of slideshows. It's a really good question. It's not something that a lot of programs can do. I know YouTube, if you want looking for a free resource that can do it, YouTube, you can annotate inside of YouTube and you can create hyperlinks in there. I think you can only hyperlink to other YouTube videos. Now there's an upside and a downside to this. The upside is that it's free. And another upside is if you are creating a YouTube video, not only is it going to be on your own website where you embed it, but it's also going to be on YouTube. So you have a little more visibility and a little bit more marketing and advertising out there just by using YouTube to showcase your videos. So that's the upside to it. The downside to it is that you will have that little opaque YouTube logo in the lower, I think it's the lower right corner of your video. So that would be a possible downside. If you wanted to link to another video, I know YouTube can do that. Again, you'll have that YouTube logo, and you know you may not want that logo in there. That's one possible option for you. If you're looking for something where you're willing to pay for it, I know inside of Lightroom you can create an image, like you can make a graphic in Photoshop or wherever, and include that in your Lightroom slideshow. So that would show up at the end over, say, 3 to 5 seconds, but that really wouldn't be an active link. You couldn't click on that, but you could include a text frame, if you will, that shows what website to go to. Another option, if you want to spend a little money, is use something on Windows called Camtasia, and you can create active hyperlinks inside of that. The problem that then introduces, though, is that creating hyperlinks in there requires, I think it's a flash-based presentation, so that can create issues if you're using platforms like an iPod or an iPad, or some Android operating systems can't view flash-based video. So that could be a possible downside there as well. Some other ones that I've heard of are not coming to mind at the top right now, so I'm just going to leave it at that. If anyone has any suggestions on this particular question, it's a great question, and I don't really have a conclusive answer other than YouTube and Camtasia, or using the native functionality of Lightroom to completely answer this question. And I know it can be done. I've seen it, but I don't know what software programs are out there that one could use. I suppose there are probably other options out there that are just not coming to mind. So if anyone has any suggestions as far as software that could do this, virtual tour software packages are the ones that I can think of, but I don't know the names of those, or hotspots or things like that that might do the trick. So if anyone knows the names of those programs or applications, feel free to contribute those in the comments section for the show notes, and hopefully we can get Robert? Yes, so hopefully we can get Robert an answer to his question. It's a great question, and hopefully those suggestions helped. I'm not sure it's a complete answer, though, so if anyone has any other feedback or contributions they can make, please do contribute those so we can hopefully help Robert out. Okay, from the long and tedious question comes the short and quick question, and this question comes from Rob in Louisiana. He doesn't give a city, so I don't know where in Louisiana he was. But Rob wrote in to ask how to do a right-click on his Mac. He has a touchpad, so I'm assuming it's a Mac laptop, and he doesn't have a right-click button. Is there a workaround for this to bring up the context menus that are available in Lightroom and Photoshop? It's an easy answer, and there's actually a couple easy answers here for you. Yes, you can use the control key on your Mac and click to get that right-link contextual menu that you're referring to. As an alternative, I would recommend, actually, I don't like the touchpad. For some reason, I've never liked the touchpad. I've always plugged a mouse in, whether it's a wireless mouse or a cordless mouse, and you can get these very cheaply these days. You can get the two-button mouse from Apple. They make a two-button mouse now that you can get off of their website or from an Apple store. But if you don't want to spend the money, and I prefer not to spend money if I can avoid it, so if you don't want to spend money or if you're on a budget, you can get a cheaper mouse that has the two-button option there and simply plug that in, because the Apple platform will recognize pretty much any USB mouse that has two buttons. So if you'd like to get that functionality without having to do the context key, or excuse me, the control key to bring up that right-click menu, you can purchase a mouse for as cheap as $5 or $10 and bring that functionality in and not have to worry about shortcuts and command keys and control keys and things like that. Good question, though, and I've gotten that from several people, so that's why that was included in the questions for this show. After Rob, we have question number 8. Question number 8 comes to us from Russell in Quebec. So, two from Canada today, eh? Russell from Quebec writes in to ask if there is a way to disable the rule of thirds crop lines. He actually wrote in ROT, so I had to remember what that stood for. Is there a way to disable the rule of thirds crop lines inside of the Photoshop crop tool? Yes, there is a way to do that inside of Photoshop. If you look at the options bar, and you have to have the crop tool active, but if you look at the options bar going across the top, there is a way you can clear that out. Now, I remember seeing this. I think this was in the NAP forums. I remember seeing a question in there about it. I think, like I said, I think it's the same question, and the ultimate conclusion is that there is no way to permanently disable the crop lines, that they're going to show back up, but you can clear them out for your current image that you're working on, your current graphic that you're working on. But once you finish working with that, and you save, and you close, and you reopen Photoshop, I think those crop lines come back, that there is no way to permanently disable that without going through a lot of programming keys to create like a hot key or a quick key to do that for you. It's probably going to be just as easy to go ahead and quickly use the options menu subtext to disable the crop line in there, because it just wouldn't be worth the time to go through all the processes needed to create the hotkey, at least in my frame of mind. If someone has a way to do this, again, please feel free, as always, to throw your comments or your questions or contributions to the comment section over on the blog, or you can share them with me via email if you prefer to remain anonymous, and I will include those to the questioner when I get that information. So thank you very much to Russell. Before we give our last question out, because I have 9 questions for this week's show, or for this month's show, I guess, depending on what schedule you're looking at, I'd like to give some quick shout-outs to the folks over at Nations Photo Lab. Nations Photo Lab is a generous sponsor of the blog and the podcast. And they've been very generous in terms of their ad contribution, and I wanted to bring something up, especially because of their contributions, that's very exciting. They actually are doing a Nation's Photo Day, and this is going to be the day after Thanksgiving. So November 26th is Nation's Photo Day. They're encouraging you to take pictures of your family, of your loved ones, and there are a lot of prizes at stake here, so if you take these pictures, you have until the end of the year to submit your pictures. And you can win. There's a ton of prizes. There's prizes coming from Rick Salmon, who's contributing autographed copies of his books. I've also contributed the 49 Photo Tips Volume 1, 49 Photo Tips Volume 2. Kerry Garrison has contributed a whole bunch of plugins from over on his Camera Dojo website. There's instruction coming from other photographers that are contributing their endeavors and services and products to the winner of this contest. And the exciting thing is I'm participating as one of the judges in this contest. So there is a Facebook page, and you'll be going out on Twitter quite a bit. You'll probably see a lot of marketing and promotional advertising coming out for this. Obviously, the goal here is to hopefully bring you into the Nation's Photo Lab as a resource for getting your business. They really produce great quality images, great prints. I've been really happy with their service, and the products that they're giving away here are just amazing. Like I said, all the ones that the judges are contributing, as well as what Nations Photo Lab is contributing, I think they're giving away like $200 or $300 in gift certificates or in print services. So it's going to be something you're going to want to check out. I'll throw a link to that in the show notes, but I did want to bring that up because they are a sponsor and it's something that's coming up very soon. So you're going to want to make sure you keep your eyes and ears peeled for that. The other contest, also just to kind of make you aware, is the one that's currently being hosted right here at Learning Digital Photography. The October winner, we didn't even have a podcast in October, so that's why it probably wasn't mentioned, but the October winner won a year of NAPP membership. And I forget what the winner's name was. I think it was Aaron Cole. He won a year of a membership to the National Association of Photoshop Professionals, so congratulations to him. And for the month of November, the winner is going to get some Red River paper. So if you're into doing your own prints, say for those of you that might want to be matting and framing your prints, and you want to print out your own images, you can do that with the paper from the folks over at Red River Paper. They're giving away a package of their Pearl Metallic Pro. This is really, really cool paper. If you want your images to really just pop and jump off the page, especially if you're doing HDR, this is great paper for HDR work. This Polar Metallic Pearl, or Pearl Polar Metallic paper, is just really perfectly suited for this. I don't know how else to say this. It's just awesome for HDR. It really makes photos pop, jump off the page. Winner of this month's giveaway is going to get a package of that. So stop in over to the Flickr forum thread for November. Contribute your photo. The theme is pop, for obvious reasons. So if you've got a photo that you want to pop when you go to print it, submit that in the Flickr thread, and you can win a package of this Pearl Polar Metallic, it's really hard to say, Pearl Polar Metallic paper from the folks at Red River Paper. I'd also like to thank them for their sponsorship of the monthly contest series as well. So having said all that, let's get to our last question of the show. Our last question for the show comes to us from Tori in Connecticut. And this is actually the reason why I positioned this one last, is this really would make a great talking point. So I'm going to hopefully answer this question and then get people to come over to the blog and actually share your comments and thoughts on this particular subject. Tori from Connecticut writes in to ask, what should I do and how should I react when I get approached by a client who does not feel that Photoshop and photography is something they should spend their money on? They come in and think that what I do is easy and can be done by anybody. And this is a really great question. It's a great discussion point. So thank you to Tori and to everyone else for writing in. But this one in particular is a great discussion point, especially given what's going on with the economy these days. Because, granted, the economy is tight and it's very difficult to not be understanding or cognizant of the economic pressures that people are facing. Having said that, if people are coming into a shop to have you do some photography or some Photoshop work for them, and they don't want to spend their money, why are they coming in? That's the big question I have. They come in because Tori actually says they come in and think that what I do is easy and can be done by anybody. Well, I'm not sure I buy into that. I think they're basically just trying to get something for nothing, because if they're coming in to have some Photoshop or some photography work done, they obviously don't think they can do it or that it can be done by anybody. Because if they did, they would not have come in the first place. So they're coming to you to get something done that they can't do themselves, or they don't want to do themselves, or they're not able to do themselves because it's not easy. And if they answer, or if they have that discussion point for you, the way to respond is, well, why are you here? You know, and if they can't answer that, if they say, well, I just don't want to do it. Well, if you don't want to do it, you have to pay someone to do it. If you don't want to pay, you can do it yourself. So that would be the response that I would give. And I'm probably not in a good position to say that because my livelihood doesn't depend on photography like it does for many people. And it's difficult to say that, especially when your bread and butter is coming from doing photography as a profession, when that really is what is paying your bills. It's hard to say no to business. Keep in mind, though, that when you start getting into discussion about finances and budgeting and economics, you're really competing. It's really tough because you're starting to compete against everybody out there. And there are people out there that are willing to do it for free. Okay, there are people out there who are willing to do photography as a service, delivering a product to a client for free, simply because they want to gain the experience. Now, of course, there's always that debate that comes up about the quality of service that you get versus the price that you're paying for that service. And the general rule of thumb is that the more you pay, generally, the better the quality. And that's a very good point, and I know a lot of people will come back and say, well, yes, but in this economy, can you really afford to turn away business? And I think at some point the answer to that actually is yes, because if you try and capture everybody, you know, you're not defining your demographic well enough is my best answer, because if you're really catering to that low end, or I shouldn't say low end, but if you're catering to the mass market mentality, you're going to lose every time. And you have to convince people that they're not just paying for the photography, the end product, the print. You're paying for the service. And the print is a significant part of it, because there's a certain element there that kind of transcends just something physical. You can't just pick up a photograph and say, oh, I paid 10 cents for this, or I paid a dollar for this, or $10 for this. There's something emotional. There's an emotional tie or an artistic tie to that image that you just can't put a number to and say, okay, well, it cost you 10 cents for the ink and 15 cents for the paper and 40 cents for the frame and 10 cents for the mat and 5 cents for the back. You can't just put a numerical value on each of those and say that's the total price, because that's not the total price. There's the time that you spent taking pictures. There's the time that you spent in post-production, cloning out that flagpole in the background or that street sign in the background, or brushing over their skin and smoothing it out and making their eyes pop. And, you know, if they can't recognize that quality and their only interest is the bottom line of money, then you probably really don't want them as a client. And that's going to be my contention for pretty much how to answer that question. And it may sound unrealistic to just say, well, show them the door. But there comes a point where you kind of have to, because if you're doing this for a living, this is what pays your bills. This is what puts food on your table. This is what keeps the lights on. And if they're not paying you enough to pay your bills or keep the lights on, you're not going to be doing this for very long. So, you know, it comes down to marketing and to picking the right demographic that's willing to recognize the difference between paying for a photo and paying for photography services. But it's a good point. I really would like to hear what other people have to say about this, so please feel free. Stop into the blog. Share your comments. Share your thoughts. Share your feedback. Feel free to email me. The address, as always, is jason@canonblogger.com. Thank you so much to everyone, to Tori and Russell and Ron and Rob and Robert and Patrick, everyone for writing in with the great questions. That there were so many more questions in this. A lot of them were repeated, but I did want to get this show out and pick the best questions from all of it to try and really get some material out there for people to listen to. Hope you enjoyed the show. I will try to get back a couple more times before the end of the year, hopefully more than once a month, so we'll get a couple more shows out before the end of 2010. Until next time, thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you here again. Happy shooting, everyone. Bye.